This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 14, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Low-income residents are being left out in the cold after promises to provide energy assistance go unfulfilled. Violence continues in Iraq. We'll hear about the course of the country's internal politics. And city officials in one Northern California town authorize an independent investigation into police surveillance. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. About 50,000 labor unionists demonstrated outside the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France today. This as the Parliament debated a revised version of the controversial Bolkestein Directive on creating a free market in services throughout the European Union. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The Bolkestein Directive caused widespread protests last year, especially in France, where it boosted the no vote in the referendum on a European constitution. But Conservative and Socialist Euro MPs have drawn up a compromise version, which is due to be voted on Thursday. The new draft states that workers will be subject to the wages and conditions of the country where they're working, rather than their country of origin as before. And it allows countries to refuse access on the grounds of security or protection of the environment, health or consumers, as well as excluding some key sectors such as mail and social services. The hard left, the Greens and the French Socialists still say they'll vote against. Even the unions are split. Some back the changes, while others say that there are still several grey areas over how controls will be enforced and the status of public services. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
The world's largest and most profitable retailer, Walmart, is feeling pressure from state legislatures, asking the company to pay a larger share of its payroll on employee health care. Martha Baskin reports from Seattle.
Similar to legislation that recently passed in Maryland and is pending in 31 other states, Washington State's Fair Share Health Care Act would require employers with more than 5,000 employees to spend at least 9% of their payroll on health care benefits. Walmart defends its benefits package by pointing out that whenever it opens a new store, it gets far more applicants than there are openings. But Walmart critics, like David Groves with the Washington State Labor Council, say the company is subsidized by taxpayers because thousands of its workers opt for government-subsidized health care instead of a company plan.
One of the ways that they are able to beat other employers on price is that they do pay less and provide less benefits. And what they've learned is that they don't need to provide health care because the government will.
Proponents of the legislation remain unsure as to whether the state legislature's Democratic leadership will bring the vote to the floor of the House by Tuesday. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
The outgoing Palestinian Legislative Council has granted broad new executive powers to the president. Manar Jibrin reports.
Late Monday afternoon, the outgoing Palestinian parliament empowered Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to appoint a new constitutional court that would have far-reaching powers, including the capacity to cancel future legislation. Hamas criticized the move, saying that it is an attempt to undermine Hamas's right to rule the parliament. Anwar Zboun, a newly elected PLC member of Hamas, described the move as illegal.
This constitutional court is illegal. Therefore, we will work to change these bills passed yesterday. We consider this as an attempt to strike the Palestinian democracy that brought us to this parliament.
The new parliament, which will have 76 Hamas members out of 132, will be sworn in on Saturday amongst increasing pressure by the United States and the donor countries to stop aid to a Hamas-formed government. This is Manar Jibrin reporting from Palestine.
A court in Argentina has issued arrest warrants for a former dictator and 12 ex-military officers for their suspected role in Operation Condor. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
A federal appeals court upheld the indictment of a group of military leaders for their alleged participation in a joint scheme to illegally kidnap and kill political activists during the 1970s. Former Argentine dictator Jorge Videla and former Interior Minister Albano Argandegui are among the suspects indicted. Most of the ex-military leaders are under house arrest in connection with other human rights abuse charges. However, because of the gravity of the charges, the court issued warrants for their arrest. If convicted, they could each face a minimum of 8 years in jail. In Argentina alone, 30,000 people were victims of Operation Condor, a shared plan by regional dictators in Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina to kill opponents in the 1970s and 80s. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona from Buenos Aires.
China has announced the country's first anti-discrimination laws against AIDS and HIV patients. Dante Tosa has more.
The new rules to protect the rights of AIDS and HIV-positive patients will take effect on March 1st. Local governments will be responsible for providing free medication to poor patients and free consultations to infected pregnant women. Also, hospitals will not be able to turn AIDS and HIV-positive patients away. However, AIDS activists in China are unsure of the effectiveness of these new regulations, saying that, for example, there are no legal consequences for a hospital that refuses service to an AIDS patient. Last month, the central Chinese government published a report stating that there are currently 650,000 people in China living with HIV, and the numbers are rising by about 200 new infections per day. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Toza with FSRN.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Home energy assistance programs are causing low-income residents to be left out in the cold, as Congress and President Bush have left promises of providing energy assistance to the poor unfulfilled. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
The two major energy assistance programs are weatherization and LIHEAP, or Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program.
These families often must make hard choices between heating and cooling their homes and other necessities like food, clothing, and medicine. On average, these families will spend more than 15% of their income on energy, compared to 5% for most homes in the country.
Bob Adams is Director of Weatherization Services at the National Association of States and Community Services Program. Most LIHEAP recipients are low income and many are on fixed incomes. The program helps eligible households pay their energy costs at a time when heating prices have risen. But the program is running out of money and a proposal to provide additional funding is tied up in Congress.
We're trying to work it out, and I've been talking to some of the individual senators. I just made a pitch in the policy luncheon on behalf of the program because it really is about what's to do what's right.
The bill would take a $1 billion advancement from the fiscal year 2007 budget proposal. Republican Senator Olympia Snow from Maine is one of the leaders of this emergency funding.
It's already paid for, and this is not an increase in the program, essentially. It's to hold harmless, where we were last year, given the current increases in energy prices, both home heating oil and natural gas.
Despite a pledge from Republican leaders in the Senate, some Republicans are holding up the funding for various reasons. Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama has said the cost is too high. And some Republican senators in southern states oppose the way the money is being allocated, saying their state won't get a fair share. The need for funding is urgent. The federal money, which is distributed to the states, has run out in 12 states, and five more are extremely close to zero, which would deny new applicants of assistance. And three more months of winter remains in some regions. But advocates are calling for the immediate passage of the bill, plus some.
To appropriate LIHEAP funding of at least $5.1 billion for fiscal year 2006, as well as an advance appropriation of at least $5.1 billion for fiscal year 2007.
Congress said they would fund $5 billion, but the actual amount passed, a little less than $2
billion. In 2005, the number of households that applied for LIHEAP assistance increased by material margin by approximately 9%, while applications from the elderly skyrocketed a whopping 34%.
Ron Jones is talking about his state of Tennessee. He is the chairman of that state's regulatory authority, which oversees LIHEAP. Nationally, only 15% of the homes that need energy assistance are receiving it. The executive branch hasn't fulfilled any hope of fully funding the program. The president proposed $2.6 billion, and if Congress takes $1 billion for their emergency advancement, that will leave $1.6 billion for 2007, with no sight of lowering energy prices. As for weatherization, the other heating assistance program, the president's fiscal year 2007 budget will cut it by 33%. Again, Bob Adams.
It's important to note
that after weatherization services are provided, the average family saves about $400 per year based on the current energy prices. The savings potential for these energy services, like insulation, furnace replacement, air infiltration reduction, and others, lasts more than 15 years in most cases.
Advocates want Congress to fully fund $600 million for the program, much more than the $160 million the president proposed. The Senate could try to retrieve some of that money through the appropriations process or with tax incentives, but no emergency funding is in place. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As the Royal Nepalese Army throttles mass protests within Nepal, thousands of Nepalese gathered in the Indian capital, Delhi, to celebrate 10 years of people's war in Nepal. The Janadakir Sudakashi Samiti, a union of Nepali workers in India, organized a mass rally vowing to fight until the end for restoration of democracy in Nepal. FSRN's Vinod K. Jose reports from Delhi.
Revolutionary cultural troops of the Maoists of Nepal and India entertained the crowd. A mobilization of over 60,000 Nepali expatriate workers in India assembled to celebrate 10 years of people's war in Nepal. Not long ago, the Nepali Workers' Unity in India, called the Nepali Ekta Manch, was banned under India's terrorism law for supporting the Maoist movement in Nepal. Many of their leaders were arrested, tortured, and extradited back to Nepal. Now, after 4 years, the Nepali workforce reunited with the name Nepali Janadhikar Samiti and extended their support to the Maoist movement. Lekna Neopai is the Central Committee President of Nepali Workers Student Union. He came to Delhi to address the Nepali workers.
This is a historic moment. 10 years of protracted people's war by the Maoists is going to establish a democratic rule in Nepal very shortly. The king and the monarchy cannot last long. So this mobilization of thousands of Nepalese is both a celebration of people's war and a statement to the world outside that Nepali Maoist movement is a genuine people's movement, contrary to what the Western, Indian, and Nepali administrations propagated all these years.
Jaipuri Gharti is the president of the Revolutionary Women's Association of Nepal.
Feudalism, patriarchy, King Gyanendra, US imperialism, Indian expansionism in South Asian subcontinent, all these are our enemies. And the Maoist movement is successfully resisting these enemies because of the support of millions of common people.
The Maoist guerrilla movement of Nepal gathered supports of both the mainstream Indian communists and the underground Indian Maoists. Sidharam Yechury is the Politburo member of Communist Party of India, Marxist.
The future of Nepal will be decided by the people of Nepal and nobody else, not Indian government nor Western military aid. We extend complete support to your fight for democracy.
10 million Nepalese live in India. Poverty and unemployment force Nepalese to look upon India, where they often end up in the most exploitative work conditions, from domestic help to construction work to sex industry. From New Delhi, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
One coalition soldier was killed and 6 were wounded in separate attacks in Baghdad today. Meanwhile, the provincial police chief in the southern province of Basra said all security cooperation and joint patrols with British officers had been called off after revelations of prisoner abuse by British soldiers in Amara, the capital of Mizan Governorate, north of Basra. As the country's new majority Shiite government increasingly asserts itself against the foreign military presence, the selection of Ibrahim Jaafari to remain in the post of prime minister leaves some concerned about the course of the country's internal politics. Salam Talib files this report, produced by David Enders.
Jaafari's selection split the alliance of Shiite parties that won the majority of seats in the parliament in January's election along party lines. It does little to assuage fears of the Sunni community, which blames Jaafari's government for being unable or unwilling to rein in the Ministry of Interior's security forces. MOI commandos have carried out raids and extrajudicial killings in Sunni neighborhoods in retaliation for attacks on Shiites and on the government. Sunday's vote came down to Jafri and Adel Abdelmehdi, who is second in command for the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the party whose paramilitaries are blamed for many of the killings. The group's security forces in southern Iraq have clashed with other local militias, particularly followers of Muqtada al-Sadr. They are considered to be more or less in charge of many local police forces, and especially in the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. As was the case last year, the decision on a prime minister was delayed until after the celebration of Ashura, the holiest holiday on the Shiite religious calendar. Under Saddam Hussein's government, the more than 1,300-year-old tradition of making a pilgrimage to Karbala was forbidden. But where many Shiites see a newfound freedom, others see a new oppressor. Ahmed al-Shamrai is a Sunni living in Baghdad.
The elections were along sectarian lines, and Sunni do not like al-Jafari, but there are many issues with Abdul Mahdi. He is the second man after Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, and he had connections to the Ba'ath Party in Saddam's time.
The alliance, which won 128 seats in the 275-member parliament, was left by other parties to select a prime minister. It also marked the first time Sadr's followers, who have the most seats within the Shiite bloc, used their electoral weight to swing a decision. Hamid Majid Musa is the leader of the Iraqi Communist Party and ran with former U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, whose parliamentary bloc won 25 seats. The Sadrists have demanded that Jafri prevent Alawi from participating in any new government because of his ties to the CIA. Musa pointed out that under Jafri's government, the war had intensified while many aspects of daily life had deteriorated, especially in Baghdad.
We have criticized al-Jafari's government for its performance, especially in terms of security and the economy and problems with services. If the United Iraqi Alliance has chosen him, they have to study this decision again and check his performance. Otherwise, the problems Iraq suffers from will not get better.
Jafri, whose term would last 4 years, oversaw a rise in oil prices shortly before the elections, something many Iraqis thought meant that Jafri would not be returning to office. The next step in forming the government will be the apportioning of ministries, and with Jafri as prime minister, it is quite likely members of Skiri will argue they should remain in control of the Ministry of Interior. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib for FSRN.
The Bush administration is widening the scope of domestic spying with the help of telecommunications giant AT&T and another secret database that targets peace activists. While the Bush administration justifies its domestic spying programs, grassroots civil rights groups are taking a stand against programs they say infringe on people's constitutional rights. FSRN's Christina Anastad reports.
The Pentagon's Threat and Local Observation Notice, or TALON, database is a listing of potential terrorist threats that includes environmental and anti-war groups. In a national effort to uncover the breadth of the TALON database, the American Civil Liberties Union has made several information requests on behalf of Greenpeace, Veterans for Peace, and dozens of social justice groups across the U.S. that are listed in the database. Lee Johnson is a geography PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of Berkeley's Stop the War Coalition, a student peace group listed on the TALON database as a threat for its anti-military recruitment protests.
We are outraged, and we should be outraged, but we shouldn't be surprised, I don't think. I think it's fairly clear that we don't pose any sort of domestic threat to this government other than the threat that the people of America, the majority of them are opposed to this war, they're opposed to George Bush, and that is a threat to this administration.
In 2003, neocon and then Deputy Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld created the TALON database to monitor potential terrorist and pre-terrorist activities. Since then, numerous peace protests and progressive meetings have been placed on the TALON database as a threat. In an email, Pentagon spokesman Gregory Hicks wrote threats are reportable events that include non-specific threats to Department of Defense interests, like tests of security, unusual repetitive activity, and any other suspicious activity. Hicks adds that law enforcement and concerned citizens report information that goes into the TALON database, but according to Rebecca Jeske, a spokesperson for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the government government also relies on major corporations to collect people's data. She claims telecoms like AT&T are giving the Bush administration unfettered access to illegally wiretap and collect their customers' calling records.
The government would have a hard time gathering the data that it does without collaborating with the telecoms. And we believe that AT&T gave the government, gave the NSA, the National Security Agency, wholesale access to its databases of historical call data. If they have an eye on a specific person, they can get a warrant. We're talking about wholesale data mining and spying on ordinary Americans. They're taking a really big bite. They are not doing something targeted. We suspect that other telecoms are doing something similar.
The Electronic Civil Rights Group has filed suit against AT&T for infringing on the privacy rights of an estimated 26 million AT&T customers by breaking the Federal Telecom Act and the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The lawsuit could cost AT&T billions. While the Bush administration widens the scope of domestic spying on peace groups and average citizens, Al-Qaeda terrorist Osama bin Laden has announced his fighters are preparing new attacks on U.S. soil. ACLU of Northern California's executive director Dorothy Ehrlich says spying on average citizens and social justice groups is a misguided waste of resources.
We're not any safer by the government engaging this kind of surveillance. There have been reports that show that the kind of fishing expeditions that they're engaged in, the fact that they are collecting information that is of very little value when we're looking for real terrorists, we're not looking for students who are engaged in dissent against the war, and that when they use their resources in this manner, they actually make us less safe, and that's a very real concern that we have.
AT&T has 30 days to respond to the class action lawsuit, and the ACLU expects a response from the Pentagon later this month. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I am Christina Onnested.
Police in Santa Cruz, California, released a 6,000-page report Friday detailing its internal probe of surveillance conducted on do-it-yourself New Year's Parade meetings. City officials who initially praised the report as thorough and complete are now backpedaling and have authorized an independent investigation. FSRN's Vinny Lombardo has more.
Grant Wilson of Santa Cruz Art and Revolution says the police investigation was a complete waste of time and resources.
It's amazing what the police can come up with in terms of material, but really in terms of substance and action, there's really nothing there.
The internal investigation was led by Deputy Chief Kevin Vogel, the same man who authorized undercover agents to infiltrate parade planning meetings. The officers involved were cleared of any wrongdoing. Vogel's report says police did nothing wrong because it claimed the New Year's parade jeopardized public safety. But Bob Aronson, the independent police auditor under contract with the city of Santa Cruz, rejected Vogel's report as incomplete and flawed, saying there was a conflict of interest.
It was inappropriate for Deputy Chief Vogel to conduct the investigation into his own decision to use undercover officers.
Aronson was tapped by City Manager Dick Wilson to conduct a supplemental investigation that will determine how and why police decided to use undercover officers to get the information they wanted.
My issue is that at first glance, without any other effort, a decision was made to try to put undercover officers into the organizing meetings.
The undercover officers used fake names and contact info, helped with parade logistics, and consumed alcohol at planning meetings. The internal audit reveals a pattern of abuses by police, says Rico Thunder, a parade planner who was a major focus of police surveillance.
The Santa Cruz PD used their presence at the planning meetings to gather information about community groups and First Amendment activities taking place. They used this information to monitor events and tip off other outside agencies.
This is the war on dissidents and the war on the Constitution come home to Santa Cruz.
Local peace activist Sherry Connable marched in the New Year's parade, but had no involvement with its planning.
It is not up to the police chief to fix this. It is not up to the city manager to fix this. It's up to us to fix it, and the only way we can fix it is if our elected representatives speak on our behalf.
Activists want a stringent policy that safeguards the First Amendment rights of citizens engaged in political work. The city's Public Safety Committee tasked with overseeing police policies, agreed to wait another month for Aronson's report before making policy recommendations. In Santa Cruz, California, I'm Vinny Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
According to Amnesty International, the Canadian government, and the Native Women's Association of Canada, Native women are targets of high levels of violence in Canadian society. That violence is being dramatically highlighted now by the opening of the trial for suspected serial killer Robert Willie Picton in Vancouver, British Columbia. Picton is accused of murdering almost 30 women over the past 20 years, many of whom were Native. Today, Native women in Vancouver and across Canada held memorial events for missing and murdered women and to call for more action from the government and society as a whole. Kristen Schwartz has more.
When Janet Henry disappeared from the impoverished downtown east side of Vancouver, her sister Sandra Gagnon took to the streets to find her. She showed Janet's photo to people in the neighborhood bars, to truckers, to random strangers. Janet was one of more than 60 women who disappeared from the downtown east side in the 1980s and 90s. One man, Robert Willie Picton, is now facing trial for the deaths of 26 of these women after their DNA was uncovered on his pig farm in nearby Port Coquitlam. Like many family members and community advocates, Sandra doesn't feel that the disappearances got enough attention.
I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't think the Vancouver City Police really took it seriously when the women started to go missing, because they were from downtown and because of the lifestyles and stuff. But I didn't think it was right, because the women were human beings. The women were mothers. They were women who were loved. They were somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's friend.
Marlene Trick is a social service worker in Vancouver's downtown east side and an organizer for the annual February 14th Memorial March for the Missing and Murdered Women, held every year since 1991. 500 people were expected to attend today's memorial.
We invite the family members of the murdered and missing women to come and speak. The march is led by elders, and behind them is the drummers and then everyone else. The theme of our march for the last few years has been "Their Spirits Live Within Us."
Grassroots organizing among Native women and the gruesome trial of Robert Picton have brought more attention to the high levels of violence against Native women across Canada. In 2004, Amnesty International released a detailed report calling for changes in policy and laws which affect Native women. Last year, the Native Women's Association of Canada won significant funding for research and education on the issue. The association estimates that more than 500 Native women have gone missing or been murdered in the last 20 years. This year, for the first time, Native women in Toronto and other cities staged events to coincide with Vancouver's Memorial March. In Toronto, a rally at police headquarters opened and closed with songs by the Anishinaabe Kwe singers. Robin Bourgeois was an organizer for the event.
What's clear is that in this country, the whereabouts of a vast number of Aboriginal women is officially unknown. And something like an epidemic is raging across this country and taking lives with impunity.
From CKLN in Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado in Los Angeles.